You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll meet a Wisconsin researcher who's working to protect unique forest habitats in tribal parts of the state. Now, the Drug Enforcement Administration issued a public safety alert this week about a huge influx in fake prescription pills labeled as things like OxyContin and Percocet that contain fentanyl. This is the first warning of this kind the DEA has issued in 6 years. Fentanyl, a drug originally designed for use in hospitals, is an opioid that can be many times stronger than heroin. In recent years, fentanyl has been showing up more and more in illicit drugs in the U.S. Drug users often don't know that they're buying drugs laced with fentanyl, putting them at higher risk of overdose and death. It's a problem across the U.S., including here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been touched by this problem? Has this affected someone in your family? If you work in healthcare or law enforcement, have you seen fentanyl showing up in your neck of the woods? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Lieutenant Matthew Ronk is the director of the Brown County Sheriff's Office Drug Task Force. Lieutenant Ronk, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Not a problem.
I know methamphetamine is a big problem in your area. I'll ask you about that in just a moment. But have you seen what the DEA is seeing in your area with this rise in fentanyl-laced illegal drugs?
Oh, absolutely. In 2020, just last year, 33% of the opiates we bought or seized on search warrants were fentanyl. We've seen a complete reverse of that this year in 2021 so far. 67% of the opiates we seize or buy on as strictly fentanyl. And that's incredibly concerning considering how dangerous it is.
Talk about the danger you see for that user who may well not know that they are buying a drug that has fentanyl in it.
Well, that's the biggest problem. So a typical heroin user might use the same amount that they are used to using, and it turns out to have a lethal amount of fentanyl in it. And we seize a fair amount of illicitly made pills that are fentanyl. They don't look like prescription. They look like prescription pills, but they don't look like they're manufactured professionally, let's say. You only need a pill press, but the fentanyl can be from 0.02 grams to 5.1 grams, milligrams, I'm sorry, of fentanyl in the pill, and it only takes sometimes 2 milligrams to be lethal in a person. So you could take twice the lethal dose for you in one pill, and the pill right next to it might just get you high.
Now, this is a global problem. Obviously, yes. There's going to have to be some kind of global solutions. That said, in Brown County, how are you tackling this?
With enforcement, in the Brown County Drug Task Force has 18 investigators assigned to it, including 3 supervisors. I would have enough work for 36, especially, 15 years ago, the problems in Brown County were cocaine and crack cocaine. I almost wish for those problems back because the meth and heroin problems that we're having now is incredibly devastating to the community, to families, and it's heartbreaking.
And can you talk about the meth problem you see in your community as well?
So, probably 2009, we first started seeing meth in measurable amounts, like a few grams here and there. Last year, because of COVID, our operations were down a little bit. We seized approximately 1,520 grams of methamphetamine. This year, so far to date, we've seized over 9,000 grams, so a substantial increase.
With the fentanyl problem, before I let you go, obviously users need a lot of help. They need big solutions. But with this fentanyl risk, what is your message to users as they're on the market looking for drugs?
Well, just buyer beware. I'm only in the enforcement angle of this entire solution. There's a lot of treatment and education that needs to be put out there. So thank you for allowing me the opportunity to talk. But I would just be very wary of what I buy and who I buy it from.
Lieutenant Ronk, thanks a lot for taking the time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Lieutenant Matthew Ronk is a member of the Brown County Sheriff's Office Drug Task Force. He talked to us about fentanyl in Brown County. Now we'll take a look at how fentanyl came to be such a dominant problem in the illegal drug trade. Ben Westhoff is a journalist and the author of Fentanyl, Inc., How Rogue Chemists Are Creating the Deadliest Wave of the Opioid Epidemic. Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You say that fentanyl is killing more Americans now than any other drug in history, I believe. Can you help us understand the scale of this part of the opioid problem?
Yeah, last year in 2020, exacerbated by the pandemic, drug overdoses accounted for 93,000 deaths, which is by far the most in American history. And the majority of those were spurred by fentanyl.
How did it rise to be such a widespread problem?
Well, fentanyl is a drug that still most people don't want. And so it's not really a user-driven phenomenon. Mm-hmm. It's more of a dealer-driven phenomenon. And it's, again, as was said before, it's about cost savings. And dealers are cutting in fentanyl to heroin, cocaine, meth, and increasingly prescription pills just because it's so much cheaper and it gives so much more bang for the buck.
I want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jay is with us in Grant County. Jay, hello.
Hi. I have been a longtime fentanyl user for medical reasons. It was prescribed to me, and I did not know how addictive it was when I was going off one medication for long-term back pain and on to fentanyl. It is a very, very difficult medication to come off of. And with it being put into illegal drugs, you know, those users aren't understanding how addictive it is. And, you know, once or two times and they're hooked. And I think the question I'd like to ask is what can be done to keep it out of the public so that it can't be used by illegal dealers? Thank you.
Jay, wow, you gave us a lot to work with there. I want to start, before we get to Jay's question, I mean, Jay got a legal prescription for it, and you studied the early history of this drug, Ben. It had a legitimate and extremely limited intention when it was invented. Can you talk about the original intent of fentanyl?
Absolutely. It was created by a Belgian chemist in the late 50s as a replacement for morphine, and it was and still is a very important medical drug. It's used for, you know, hospital purposes like open heart surgery. It's used in epidurals during childbirth and for colonoscopies for men. It's for cancer patients. It's still very important. But the key difference is that all of the hospital fentanyl is doled out by professionals, by anesthesiologists. People know exactly how much to give out because such a tiny amount in the wrong direction can kill you. The illicit fentanyl that we're talking about comes from a completely different source. You know, it's made in China, it's manufactured by the Mexican cartels and shipped up through the southern border generally. And the drug dealers, the traffickers, these are not trained professionals who know how to mix these drugs properly. And so often, you know, people have no idea what they're getting.
And Jay's question then, how do we get it under control? You mentioned this is made in China. You don't have to grow vast poppy fields to generate this. You can have a lab. It's not a particularly complicated chemical process. And that, it sounds like, Ben, makes it really hard to control this.
Unfortunately, it really is. And that's the million-dollar question, is how do we stop this from getting in? But unfortunately, it's only becoming more difficult, not less. And so when you think about before, smuggling heroin, for example, that's a bulky drug. And so it's easier for law enforcement to detect going through the border. But fentanyl, it's only, you know, it's 50 times more powerful than heroin, which means you only need 1/50th as much to be equivalent. And so it's really kind of a needle in a haystack approach. It's not only coming through the border, but being sent through the mail, the U.S. Postal Service, UPS, ordered off the dark web often. And so it can just be a very small package that you would never imagine had drugs in it.
We're talking to Ben Westhoff, journalist, author of the book Fentanyl Inc., How Rogue Chemists Are Creating the Deadliest Wave of the Opioid Epidemic. New DEA public safety advisory says more fentanyl is showing up, especially in counterfeit drugs, counterfeit prescription drugs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see harm reduction strategies in place? We'll talk about that. Do you have a story about fentanyl's impact on you or someone in your life. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation. Hear from some more of you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk now with Ben Westhoff, author of the book Fentanyl, Inc. The DEA issued a public safety alert this week about a spike in fake prescription pills containing the synthetic opioid fentanyl. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions. Let's go back to your calls now. Evan is with us in Madison. Evan, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about, Evan?
Well, back in 2017, I lost my best friend to an accidental fentanyl overdose. He apparently had ordered what he thought was heroin off the dark web, and there was, I guess, enough fentanyl in there to kill him. I remember hearing that the paramedics tried giving him something like 8 doses of Narcan and weren't able to revive him. And I tried to help the police in investigating, figuring out, you know, what happened. And the police department seemed completely not equipped to do anything about it as far as finding out, you know, where it came from or how it happened. And the same with the paramedics. I mean, I guess I just wanted to, and I know that there are, you know, thousands and thousands of other people who've gone through the same thing. I just wanted to share the story and Evan, just wonder if there's anything that can, it just seems like there's nothing people can do if it, you know, happens.
Evan, thank you so much. And I'm so sorry for the loss of your friend there. Evan brought up the dark web. His friend had gotten this, what he thought was heroin there. You pursued these threads, Ben. You met people on the dark web, sometimes met them in person. How hard is it if someone buys through this illicit online forum? How difficult is it? Is it for like a local police department to have any idea where that came from?
It's almost impossible. The ways to disguise yourself on the dark web and the encrypted messaging is basically foolproof. The dealer has to sort of make a mistake on the clear web in order to be able to trace back to his IP and address and stuff like that. So that I think is sort of the wrong way, the wrong approach anyway. I don't think we're ever going to really be able to stop fentanyl and other drugs from getting into this country. I think we really have to focus on the users. And this is what we talked about with harm reduction, trying to make so they are better educated, first of all, and then using more safely. And I can get into that, or you can talk about that if you.
I want to spend our last few minutes on that. I want to bring on another caller, though, before we get into that. Evan, thanks for being willing to share that story. Jason joins us now in Madison. Jason, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What did you want to share with us, Jason?
Well, I was on my way to pick up my son from school. My 17-year-old daughter just kind of came clean with us about a month ago that she's been addicted to Percocet / fentanyl / whatever they put in those pills. And so as a family, we're going through a kind of a detox / hopeful recovery, but she's having too much fun with it, you know, and she's about to be an adult. She makes way too much money as a tipped employee, and she has cash every day, and the cops won't let us duct tape her to anything and hold her down because we can't force, mm-hmm. you know, we can't force any kind of inpatient therapy on her, or even we can't even drug test her without her consent. So this epidemic and the fentanyl and all these different drugs that kids are using, a lot of it is for fun, but then some of it is also for masking mental health issues. That's where we think this started from. I mean, I know that 2 doses of anything, if it's really good, can make you want to keep doing it. But I think worse than that is when you're trying to to run away from your own little demons, or you need some help that no one in your family is trained to give you, that drugs seem to be the next best option. So that's what I wanted to contribute. So thank you, guys.
Jason, thanks for sharing that. I got daughters your age. I'm pulling for you. I'm sorry. Ben, can you talk about what might be available for a family in that situation?
Well, that's a very difficult situation he described, because, yeah, his daughter is about getting to the age where she has her own autonomy and can move out of the house and all that. You know, if and when she's ready, there fortunately are a lot of resources available. And, you know, we're lucky that in the fight against opioids, we have three different medications to fight it: methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone. The latter is less discussed, but can be extremely effective because it's an opioid blocker. And so if you take a shot called Vivitrol, you can't get high at all for 25 days. And it's very effective for a lot of people. These sort of detoxing and going away to these retreats, and you might get sober for a month or two, but then the rate of relapse is very high. And so I recommend what's known as medication-assisted treatment. And that's just not giving someone these drugs, but it's also combined with talking with a therapist and really working through exactly the type of issues that the caller was speaking about. Because often if someone can get in the right place with themselves, with their lives, with their jobs, that's the biggest hurdle. It's not even just the drug itself.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. We're talking to Ben Westhoff, author of the book Fentanyl, Inc., about the rise of fentanyl and more counterfeit prescription drugs and other illegal substances. Ben, let's get into harm reduction now. You share toward the end of your book some stories, a testing strip available, used by party culture, rave party culture, to see if fentanyl is showing up in their drugs. Can you talk about that and the potential it has?
Absolutely. The biggest problem, I think, really with the fentanyl epidemic is education, because so many people don't even realize that fentanyl is in your drugs. And so, first of all, you have to start by assuming that any drug that you have, any pill or any powder from the black market, could have fentanyl in it. And so these testing kits, though, are very cheap. I recommend one called the Bunk Police. It's a online company, just B-U-N-K and police. And you dip in these testing strips and a solution with your drugs, you dip in the strip, and it's just like a pregnancy test. It'll give one line if there's fentanyl, two line if there's not. And studies have shown that drug users, if they know there's fentanyl in there, will be less likely to use them. So these drug checking kits are not just for fentanyl, but for all drugs. You know, if you really want to, if you're at a party and someone gives you cocaine or an ecstasy pill, you're really not going to want to take that unless you check it first.
I've also talked to a public health expert, wanted to get your thoughts about this, on the idea of some people who are addicted to opioids maybe supplying them with a low dose of opioids for maybe long periods of time, because you know what's in them, you can control the quantity and quality. Maybe they can kick the habit in a year or two, but in the meantime, you massively lower that risk of overdose. What do you think of that idea, Ben?
Are you talking about in a
medical setting? Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's called a substitution treatment, and a lot of people have a lot of success with that. And, you know, with something like methadone is the most famous, and, you know, some people are on that the rest of their lives, and you know, to some people, it sounds like substituting one drug for another, but when it's saving people's lives, that certainly is a benefit.
Are there other harm reduction strategies that you think could make a big difference, given how hard it is to stop the supply of these drugs?
Yeah, one of the previous callers mentioned Narcan, and everyone should have that available to them. If, you know, not just police, not just first responders, but anyone you know who has an opioid issue, you should keep some Narcan on hand. I mean, it's really a miracle drug. It revives people who would die from any opioid, heroin, fentanyl, prescription pills. But, you know, to me, harm reduction just has a lot to do with reducing stigma as well. And the sooner that we start to realize, it doesn't mean you failed as a parent. It doesn't mean that we're failing as a society. It's just, this drug abuse can happen to anyone. And the sooner we start treating it like a public health problem instead of, you know, just feeling shame about it, the more success we're going to have.
When it comes to addiction treatment, as you mentioned, there are things that work, that we know that work. Do we have enough of them? Is there enough access to treatment that people can afford?
Well, the good thing is that federal funding is finally really kicking in. And so I discussed before this this opioid blocker called naltrexone, and it normally would cost like $1,000 a shot. But now in a lot of places, you can get it for free. And the same with methadone, buprenorphine. In a lot of cases, fentanyl testing strips are really cheap, if not free. Narcan is often available for lower prices. And so yeah, we're finally getting to a place where these programs are getting the funding that they need.
Ben, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
That's Ben Westhoff, journalist, author of the book Fentanyl Inc., How Rogue Chemists Are Creating the Deadliest Wave of the Opioid Epidemic. We talked about fentanyl after a DEA advisory warning people of the presence of the dangerous synthetic opioid in a lot of counterfeit prescription medications turning up on the drug market. Coming up, emerald ash borers are still a real threat to many forests. We'll talk to a Wisconsin forest researcher who's monitoring the forested wetlands on Menominee and Stockbridge Muncie tribal lands. You can follow all of these discussions anytime you want to at WPR.org. Stream the Ideas Network live or go back to our archives to see something you might have missed in the past. You can also download the Wisconsin Public Radio app to your smartphone. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the iPhone 13 just hit the shelves last week. If you can't seem to remember what iPhone release we're on, or if it matters, our next guest will help sort things out for us. Now, trying to understand the health of a forest is no small task. Our next guest has been using multiple monitoring systems throughout the pandemic on areas of forested wetlands to get a better idea of the most effective ways to protect an important natural and cultural resource. Angela Wapochik is a PhD student in forests and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a research forester for the Menominee Tribal Enterprises. She's currently monitoring a forest wetland research project in the Menominee and Stockbridge Muncie tribal lands near Kashina in northern Wisconsin. I talked to her about her work yesterday. Angela, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Can you tell us about the kind of woodlands you're studying, first of all?
Sure. So my research as a student at UW, I'm looking at black ash dominant wetlands. So particularly I study wetlands that are on the two tribal reservations that I belong to, on the Menominee Indian Reservation and the Stockbridge Muncie Reservation. So largely our wetlands are mixed species wetlands, forested wetlands, with black ash and red maple, birch, and other species.
And you mentioned the key word there, ash. Among other threats, we have these emerald ash borers. Is that part of why you're particularly interested in this ecosystem?
It is. So prior to returning to graduate school, I worked as a wetland specialist, and my job was to manage wetlands. And I became particularly fond of forested wetlands just because that's the dominant wetland in my tribal community. So I think many of us come to learn and experience the presence of emerald ash borer and the loss of white ash and green ash in our yards and golf courses and similar. But for black ash and forest wetland systems, the impacts from emerald ash borer are going to be much more devastating, in that, you know, the hydrology is going to change and that we don't know really what the impacts are going to be across the landscape.
Before we look into the details of how you are studying this, what is your big picture goal with the kinds of monitoring you're doing?
What I'd like to do is deliver a set of strategies to these tribal programs that manage our forests, and deliver a set of strategies that are going to be implementable, that are reasonable, and that we can actually make some progress with adaptive management.
One of the techniques you're using, I understand, is bioacoustic monitoring. So the sound of the forest. What is that and what does it tell us?
Sure. So birds, insects, amphibians, and what my community refer to as creepers and crawlers, they all make sounds. And these sounds are picked up by recording devices. And we assess them and they provide insight about the biodiversity and the health of the forest. So for these two tribes that manage the forest and their goals include, you know, protecting biodiversity, this tool can be used beyond the focus of just managing black ash systems, which is my focus, but we can use them long-term to determine, you know, the health of our entire forest. So in my research, I began to learn how to use this monitoring, but also I'm hoping that maybe the tribes can continue to use this and we can collect these sounds to detect changes in our forest health. And it's an effective way to determine the effectiveness of how we manage our forest.
That's interesting. But I understand that's not the only kind of monitoring you're doing. What else do you do apart from being in the forest? What other kinds of monitoring do you have in place?
Sure. So another type of monitoring I do is sap flux density. And what I'm doing there is I'm measuring whole tree water use. And I hope within these areas that I monitor within both tribal forests that I can determine the whole tree water use and scale these measurements to determine the entire stand water use in these forest ecosystems. So what I do is I have these little homemade small sensors that are set into the tissues of the tree. And the two probes, I'm able to measure the difference in heat or temperature between the two probes. And that can help me determine how much sap flow is running through the tissues of the tree. And that role of the individual, and that will tell me the role of the individual tree in that particular stand. So how is that helpful? Then it helps me determine the water cycle or the water budget of these systems. And I can determine perhaps what areas we expect that are going to have the largest change in hydrology.
You said these are homemade sensors. You're building your own tools here?
I am.
Cool.
I am.
Now, I understand you had a team ready to help you in 2020. And then 2020 happened, COVID. You had to recruit some help from very close to home, inside your own home, right?
I did. At the time, my son was 16. I had partners with the Forest Service and other undergraduates here at UW that were set to help, and travel restrictions prevented that. And I had I put in months of work and preparing for my field season, and I wasn't about to let that go. So my husband and my son actually stepped to the plate and helped me set up my sites. And it took a little bit longer, but we were successful. And in doing so, I trained a field hand. And, this was 2 years ago. And even this year, my son now is a full-time technician working on my project.
Now, I mentioned ash borers as one of the threats facing this ecosystem. I know a lot of ecosystems are threatened by various kinds of human development. Is that a problem with these kind of forest wetlands that you're working in?
So the difference, so we can put a label on forested wetlands, and based on the species composition or the hydrology, and whatever system we use to classify these systems is appropriate. And we expect that these certain classification that these wetlands are function similarly, but the individual site dynamics are important. And just like people, forested wetlands have their own characteristics and quirks. And what I see in my project sites is that current management and historical land use definitely have a big control on the site hydrology. And I have to account for how we use the land around surrounding these systems for the response. And largely the end goal is, I want to determine and prioritize areas to manage. So if there's ways that impact or how we use the land impacts the hydrology, maybe some sites aren't going to be as suitable for management as others.
And I understand you're hoping to educate not just policymakers, but us in the general public too, about the importance of these ecosystems. What are you hoping the rest of us can learn from your work?
Sure. As a previous natural resource manager, I think one of the largest frustrations I had was that I would prepare management plans or project plans. And I wanted the tribal community or even the larger community to read these plans and provide me feedback. And that, you know, largely wasn't the case. And I'm really hoping maybe through my graduate career, I find strategies that I can share how we manage our resources, and people are more invested in how we manage their resources because they're using these resources. So that is something I'm working on. I don't know the answer, but I definitely want the tribal community to be more engaged in how we manage their resources.
Angela, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
That was Angela Wapachik, a PhD student in forests and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a research forester for Menominee Tribal Enterprises. She's currently monitoring a forest wetland research project in the Menominee and Stockbridge-Munsee tribal lands. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about the origins of a regional name for a chicken barbecue.
As part of Wisconsin Public Radio's Wisconsin project, we received a question from Mary Lee, who grew up near La Crosse. She asked, what is the origin of the chicken queue? Well, chicken queue is a name for a charcoal-grilled chicken dinner sold as part of a fundraiser, but the name is only known regionally in the La Crosse area. Andrea Anderson has more on the mystery of the chicken queue.
So on the count of three. One, two, three.
It's a hazy summer day at a busy intersection in La Crosse. Rooster Andy's Catering is preparing charcoal-grilled half-chicken dinners, complete with beans, potato salad, and a roll. Today's proceeds benefit a school's basketball program. Dan Parisi of La Crosse waits in line for his order. He frequents chicken queues a couple times a month. He likes the convenience of not having to cook and the taste of grilled chicken, but the name chicken queue escapes him.
I just assume barbecue chicken. I don't know. I have no idea where it came up. I have no clue.
Even the professionals are unsure. Three catering companies run chicken queue events in the La Crosse area, and they just have theories about where the name chicken queue comes from. Rooster Andy's grill master, Andy Faulkner, says if you drive much outside of La Crosse, no one has even heard of the chicken queue.
Not really. Even as close as Rochester, most people just aren't aware of what a chicken queue is.
On one side, three pits at a time. I go down the other side and somebody threw a match in. Boom, boom, boom.
In the basement of Holy Trinity Catholic Church in La Crosse, people who've put on their own chicken queues for decades sit around and tell old war stories. Jean Jursa organized the church's first chicken queue back in 1970. His theory of how the name came to be is as solid as anyone's.
D.R. Schultz was a bearded servant, and he had his employees that would work these chicken queues when they started getting into them.
E.R. Schultz, or Elmer, was a beer distributor in La Crosse after Prohibition. Newspaper ads from the 1930s and 40s say he stocked brands like Blatt's and Kingsbury. A Facebook post on a La Crosse history page says E.R.'s brother, Art, ran Arcadia Friars in Trempealeau County, just north of La Crosse. Arcadia Friars was the longtime name of a chicken farmers cooperative started in the 1920s that still exists today under the name Pilgrims. Jursa says Holy Trinity used to get the chicken it served from E.R. Schultz.
We got all the chicken from Arcadia Friars. Arcadia had all the chicken.
The concept of a chicken dinner fundraiser is not unique to La Crosse, but the name Chicken Queue is. There are thousands of references to chicken queues in old files from the La Crosse Tribune, but no accounts explaining where or how the name started. In the 1970s, Holy Trinity Catholic Church used to sell more than 3,000 chicken dinners twice a year to benefit the church and the Boy Scouts. While the church still does two fundraisers each year, they are about half in sales of what they once were. Ron Fitzpatrick took over from Gene Jursa as organizer.
It's very hard to get people to volunteer. When Gene was involved and I first got involved in it, people were here from 5 a.m. till 7 o'clock at night. Now you have people that'll come for a couple hours here and a couple hours there, and I take whatever I can get.
Chicken queues remain popular, with some nonprofits still organizing them. A cottage industry started in the 1980s with professional caterers now arranging chicken queues, with proceeds going to nonprofits.
Andrea Anderson brought us that story on the chicken queues of La Crosse. This story was produced by John Davis. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Colbert.
Coming up, Apple has released the iPhone 13, which includes things like a better camera and longer battery life, but no big changes. A technology expert joins the show with the latest and a look at why some people get excited about these new releases. That's up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, polls suggest the president's child care plan, is popular with both Democratic and Republican voters. Join Jen White to hear how things might change and whether Congress is ready to act. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now it's that time of year again. Leaves will turn, pumpkin things are everywhere, and a new iPhone is released into the wild. Last week, the iPhone 13, including a mini and pro version, was released with no big changes, but some tweaks like improved cameras and a battery that can last longer. Are you keeping up with the latest releases? Do you care to? Our next guest adds some context to the new technology. Steve Knoll is a marketing professor and social media expert at Madison College. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again, Rob.
Before we look into the developing technology, Steve, I know there's a subculture anyway that is really excited and looks forward to the annual release of the new iPhone. What is it about those hardcore fans that has them so interested in new releases?
Well, it's the magic of marketing is what it is. So, you know, Apple certainly knows what they're doing in terms of making their products have this kind of magical allure that, interesting enough, a lot of people assume the iPhones are the most state-of-the-art technology, and they're not. But no other brand has the type of appeal that Apple seems to be able to have this formula year after year. Everyone keeps saying, oh, this will be the last year of a big release. And then, you know, last year we saw it was the biggest release yet. So we'll see where this new batch takes us.
Are people out there buying the new phone that comes out every year? I'm not that kind of person, but do they exist?
I'm not the kind of person either. as much as I'm a fan of Apple, I do try to keep some common sense. But yeah, there are. You know, it's really no different than a lot of other. There's people who get a brand new car every year because that's just what their thing is. You know, Apple certainly relies on these super fans to generate a lot of positive word of mouth on social media to kind of augment what they're already spending big bucks on traditional media with.
Looking at this new release, staying with iPhone for now before we look at some of the other technology on the market, in this release, was there a big splash, or is this, we made this a little better, this a little better?
It's a little splash. You know, certainly the camera is a little nicer. But last year, the 12 had a significant upgrade in their cameras. This year, it's a little enhancement. Their screen, what's called the refresh rate, has gone up significantly. It does have a little better picture. But again, other brands rolled this out several years ago. So for Apple, it's new, but really, it's not anything really revolutionary. You know, the battery, you know, every year the batteries do get a little better. You know, the one notable thing is the storage space. Their big model now has a 1 terabyte storage capacity, which basically would allow you to download every episode of Star Trek, all the different series, every movie, and still be able to download pretty much every song that's come out in the last 25 years. So it's a lot. There's no excuse to not have something to watch on your phone.
If people bought the new release last year, or even the year before, is this the time to spit on that old antiquated phone and rush out and buy the new thing? Or do you think they should roll with what they got for a while?
Well, that really depends on how you feel about this stuff. you know, I there were a lot of things missing, I have to admit. I had a little more hope for a few extra features that did not show up. You know, a couple of years ago, Apple got rid of the thumbprint reader and went to a face recognition way to unlock the phone, which actually is a more secure way of doing it. But, you know, we're still walking around with masks on our face. And the iPhone face reader has a problem with that. There was talk that the latest operating system would recognize your face even if you're wearing a mask. That has not materialized yet. And, you know, not being able to unlock the phone with just your thumbprint, you know, definitely is something that was a bit of a disappointment. I don't think they'll go back to a thumbprint thing, but I'm kind of surprised they haven't addressed a better mask-ready facial recognition unlocking system.
Talking to Steve Knoll from Madison College about the cutting edge of phone technology after the release of the latest Apple iPhone. Steve, you mentioned Apple kind of has the mystique of being on the cutting edge, but you said a few moments ago it ain't necessarily so. Where are you seeing the coolest stuff right now?
Well, Apple is certainly the coolest stuff, but I think what you want to know is what is the most state-of-the-art stuff.
Yeah, that.
And in the industry, there's kind of a running joke that if you want to know what's going to be on the next iPhone, check out what Samsung added to their phone last year. You know, there seems to be about a two-year cycle where Apple is behind, you know, their big competitor by about 2 years in terms of technology. But, you know, Apple can certainly, you know, and part of that might be by design. You know, a lot of times, you know, new technology comes with a lot of bugs. For example, you know, a phone that folds up, you know, these folding screen technology was introduced a couple years ago. It had a lot of bugs, and then the industry has kind of backed down from that idea. Apple never embraced it. I think they want somebody else to kind of figure it out before they kind of show up and make it uber sexy. And that's really what you're getting with Apple. It's not necessarily state of the art, but you're definitely part of the cool kids if you've got that fancy Apple logo on your electronics.
What is a cutting edge thing you've seen on, say, a Samsung phone that we might see on an Apple phone in a couple few years?
Well, one of the things that's really interesting is this foldable idea, this idea that, you know, that a phone and a tablet like an iPad are probably going to merge together. So instead of having a separate iPad and an iPhone, you'll have one device that you can fold down to the size of a phone, and then you'll be able to unfold it to the size of a tablet. You know, that technology, I think we're going to see that sooner than later, but it won't be from Apple. I think that's definitely where Samsung has got a better idea with how to do that. You know, the ability to have even though the phones are very thin, we can't roll them up yet. You know, I think we're going to be seeing things like that. The other thing too is, you know, and this has been a big annoyance for people that are not fans of Apple, is they have a proprietary charging port, and the EU is introducing legislation to mandate that all consumer electronics use a USB-C connector, and all the other manufacturers do except Apple. So there's been speculation that Apple is going to drop the connector entirely and go to charging it wirelessly along with everything connected to it, like headphones and earbuds are all going to have to be Bluetooth. So I think that's another thing, that it's only a matter of when, not if, that this will happen, not only on Apple, but I do see that that's the future for all of these small electronics, which means everybody will be able to finally clean out the junk drawer of all those charging cables that don't fit anymore.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Cool. Thanks, Rob. Great for having me.
That's Steve Knoll, marketing professor and social media expert at Madison College. He joined us to talk about the new iPhone 13 released last week and the cutting edge of cell phone technology. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, insects are a key to ecosystems all over the planet, but a lot of species face threats or even extinction. Meet the author of the new book, Silent Earth. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news. Then we'll take our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics, including infrastructure, the debt ceiling, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.